Colleagues, good morning. I'm very pleased to be here to be able to share with you some of our HMI findings. And can I say that I'm accompanied by my colleagues who I know are equally pleased to be here. My job, obviously, is to try and set the ball rolling. And by ball rolling, I mean what is important at this conference are your views, not mine or any of the speakers. We are just setting out a scene. What is really interesting and what will be interesting is your discussions and what decisions you make and what recommendations you produce in your working groups. Now, I think in this very short time I've got, what might be useful is if I set out for you some of the findings that inspectors, in their whole school inspections and in their history subject visits to schools, have found over the last 3 years, and which we've already reported on in our last 3 annual reports. So I'm saying nothing new, but I do think it's important just to remind us all of the backdrop, at least as far as HMIs see it. Then I will use this evidence to say something about the implications for the future of history, and indeed, why history matters. Some of my PowerPoints are a little repetitious, but that's because they come at things through different ways. By looking first at standards and then looking at teaching and learning, and looking then at the curriculum, I hope you will see that they all add up to a coherent message. Now, Key Stage 1, on the whole, goes reasonably well. And I say this because Key Stage 1 teachers know children well, and they focus in particular on literacy and numeracy, and in the very best schools, they work their history into that literacy and numeracy, and I suppose we should say personal development as well. Thus, they meet a whole range of children's needs. Now, what I'm going to say throughout my talk here is a generalization. There'll be exceptions at both ends, and obviously in Key Stage 1, there are schools where history is barely touched on at all, and others where it's really, really something splendid. I can remember not long ago sitting on a mat with some children as we explored objects from the past. This was year 2. And the judgments, the decisions they were making, the observations were really, really just breathtaking. And that was largely down to the very skillful choice that the teacher made of objects and the way in which she encouraged children to speculate, ask questions, and to actually discuss with one another what they were finding. And they didn't agree. And so even in year 2, pupils have discovered that it's possible to have different interpretations. When it comes to Key Stage 2, HMI are more concerned, and that's because it's 4 years of the national curriculum, and it's demanding both in knowledge, content, and in skills development. Some schools now operate a 2-year Key Stage 3, so we're talking about half the national curriculum being delivered in Key Stage 2, and we sometimes forget that. And yet, what we're finding is that children experience pockets of knowledge, which they very often enjoy, don't get me wrong, and it's splendid to see them enjoying a Victorian day, which they'll remember for the rest of their lives, but if you're really talking about serious history, then too many idiosyncratic bits of history mean that you don't get any form of progression, that older children are not doing fundamentally anything different from younger children. They may be doing different bits of knowledge, but in terms of the progression in skills, in terms of understanding, then it's not there very often. Key Stage 3 and 4, well, yes, students do well in history compared to other subjects, but, and there's always a but with HMI, so I apologise for that, students are still doing a few topics in depth. They can't tell you an overarching story and provide a continuous narrative. And then we've got weaknesses in certain areas, in particular interpretation. I'm not sure that together we all know precisely what it means, interpretation, or what we're looking for, and that's a problem. And then there's the ongoing debate about sources and source evaluation, and we still need to improve on the quality of communication. On this latter point, as historians, we're developing our use of information and communications technology, but it's still not good enough. It's still a long way from what it could be, and of course we barely touch the media, and by that I'm referring, for example, to video, to sound, presentation, the sort of issues that curators have to deal with in developing any form of presentation. These are not things we do a lot of in history, and yet most adult history is delivered in these forms, or is received in these forms. Declining standards, question mark? This is a big chestnut, isn't it? It's the one which always appears in the press. Now, I'm not going to get into the business of grades, grade boundaries, and the sort of decisions that examiners are making. That's not my province, it belongs to the QCA. But as far as inspectors are concerned, and in general terms, we don't see a decline in standards. When I was producing this slide, I was reminded. I was taught history in secondary school by an absolutely brilliant man, a lively man, but I'd probably give him a grade 4 now if I inspected him. If I went and visited one of his classes, I don't know what I'd think now. He used to deliver most of his history sitting down, with his feet up on his table, and he had a notebook in front of him on each topic, and he read from this with the occasional stop for discussion, and we copied down the notes. It was dictation. And we then regurgitated these in examinations, and I passed, and I did brilliantly well. So you could say, well, okay, it worked, didn't it? But on the other hand, I wasn't very good at history. I wasn't very good at asking questions. I wasn't very good at searching out answers, finding evidence, and then reaching my own conclusions. But I wrote well. It was essay after essay after essay. So there were ends that were good, but compared to my experience at school, comparing my experience at school with what you see in classrooms today, well, sometimes what you see today is absolutely stunning compared to the sort of thing that I experienced, the range of skills that lead to, at the end of the day, a piece of brilliant quality work. It's not there all the time, of course, but that's what we're looking for. Shorter answers are sometimes criticised, but the modern world demands short answers, and to produce, as I saw recently, a question which was for 7 marks, explain the reasons for the demise of the Labour government in 1951, well, anybody who can put that into a few lines, to do it cogently, to get to the point without a lot of rambling around, has done brilliantly well. And of course there are also essays. Well, it's wrong to say there are no essays within the A-level structure. There clearly are. They tend to be shorter, and again, they require that you write clearly and to the point. But as I've said, even despite these essays, longer narrative is important. The chance to tell longer stories is critical, and that's why I think that coursework is very valuable, and why we're very pleased that A-level coursework has been retained in history. On teaching and learning, it follows on from what I've said, that teaching is satisfactory in Key Stage 1 and it's satisfactory in Key Stage 2, but problematic because teaching doesn't encourage progression. Why is this? Well, critical is the fact that teachers are not qualified. Really, a lot of them are not qualified, and that's not a criticism, it's not the teacher's fault. Many of them now won't have done history themselves since they were 14. In primary, there's very little history teaching in initial teacher training courses for PGCE. I had a colleague from one university phone me up last week saying, well, it's 3 hours for history on the ITT course. That's all trainees they get. That's all the trainees get. In addition, CPD is limited. It is available, but you may not be available to go to that particular CPD. And although there's a lot of printed material around, if Key Stage 2 teachers are sitting on their own in school, they may not have the confidence or knowledge to try some of the things suggested. In Key Stages 3 and 4, yes, teaching is good. But we still see too much direct input from teachers at a time when we recognise the need to try and get children to be more independent, moving to more independent learning. This may be easy for an inspector to say, of course, but we do recognise to set up independent learning, particularly in a history context, in a small classroom with rows of desks, with the resources all over the place, and access to only a few computers, is actually quite difficult. But this is what we're trying to move to. So at the moment, still too much talking with children. Sorry, I said that wrongly. Still too much talking at children. And then there's not enough differentiation still. And we're not talking here just about meeting the needs of the whole ability range in class. We're talking about inclusion, differentiating the curriculum. How suitable is it to the range and backgrounds of children that are in your class? And so to the curriculum. I've been talking about this already. I've been talking about the limited areas of history covered by the present curriculum and its lack of coherence. So a young person can't tell a coherent narrative. And in these limited areas of history, there's significant history left out. I'm not going to say what bits of history, because as soon as I do that, we'll be here all day arguing about importance of this bit or that, but it's something you may want to think about in your groups. Just to give you an example of what I've been saying, and I'm not making it up, these are some real curricula. Two examples. This is a Year 3 one. You can see in the PowerPoint how the children move from the Romans to the Second World War and back to ancient Egypt. And children get muddled. One child talked to me about how Howard Carter actually met the pharaohs, which I suppose he did figuratively, but the child was totally muddled. I mean, that's just a little anecdote, but you get the point. And I strengthen the point by showing you this example from Year 7, where we move again from the Middle Ages through to Martin Luther King, and then on to the Second World War. But the main message, the main curriculum message I want to put across to you, or one of the main messages, is that history is marginal in the curriculum. At key stages 1 and 2, there's perhaps understandable emphasis on literacy and numeracy, but history could be brought in more. It could be linked much more with particularly the development of literacy. And in key stage 4, only just about 30% of young people study the subject, and even less post-16. And if we go to a 2-year key stage 3, as some schools are doing, of course it becomes the case that even fewer students are doing history for any length of time. Which is a challenge for you. Well, it's a challenge for all of us, but particularly for teachers, because are you happy with what I've just said? Do we just take it as read that only 30% of young people study history, when our evidence shows that more could benefit from it? Or should you be doing something about it in schools? And should others be saying more clearly that all children should be doing history? Why is history marginal? Well, I'm suggesting to you that it's not relevant enough. It's not relevant enough for all learners. If I want to be really provocative, if I see a Motte and Bailey castle being made, I ask the question, why? Is it the most relevant thing? Well, I'm not saying it shouldn't be taught, but you really have to know why. Or if I see the Tudors being studied, or Henry and his wives, why? Why is it being studied as opposed to something else? What is the choice that has been made, and why has that choice been made? The critical point I want to put forward is that a lot of what is taught in school history at the moment fails to address the overarching every child matters principle of looking after young people and helping them prepare for their futures. School history, as opposed to academic history, has to do two very difficult jobs. It has to be as good as academic history in every sense of the word, but it also has the job of preparing young people to live and work as adults in society. It has to help explain to those young people how things have got to be the way they are. Therefore, the choice of what is taught in the curriculum is vital. In addition, I've already mentioned that we're rather poor on inclusion in the widest sense of the word. It's English history rather than British history, and above all, we neglect the stories of peoples now living in the UK. I've also mentioned about the use of media, referred to in the first bullet point of this PowerPoint, and so too is the second in the post-16 context. School history really doesn't reflect enough the way that most people get their history today. So it's a time of change. The National Strategy, in particular, is emphasising the development of links, history and of course, we've We've heard the QCA launch its initiative last week, and that's fair enough. I've talked about the way in which history, and particularly literacy, can be interplayed much more. But we've got to be careful. I was in a primary school where they said, great, we're going back to topics, integration. And out came the topic webs. The one that was being done at the time was the Sands of Time, which linked the ancient Egyptians to other subjects. The problem there was that when you put all these history topics alongside each other over the years, they didn't add up to any sort of progression in history. The focus had become the topics, not the history within them. So if you're going to move down that link of integration or interrelation, you've got to be very careful that you plan first the progression in each subject, including history. We've also got the citizenship debate that's going on, linked to Britishness, and the Ajegbo proposals which have just come out. Now, of course, if Gordon Brown was here, he'd be talking to you from the basis of his interest in Britishness. I haven't come at it that way. I've come at it from the educational basis of Every Child Matters, which is at the root of all Ofsted's inspection. I haven't just plucked it out of anywhere. All Ofsted's inspection is based on Every Child Matters, focusing on the needs of children and how best to meet them. And then finally, of course, we've got the QCA revisions to the national curriculum. Key Stage 3 has just issued the invitation for us all to comment on the proposals. Key Stage 4 is being revised. A-level criteria have already been revised. And then in due course, I presume, but don't know, that Key Stages 1 and 2 will be looked at. All I can say about all these changes is that's the future. And inspectors deal with as is and what they've seen. What I can say, however, is the obvious. It's clearly important that the changes are coherent. For example, we've got the national curriculum up to Key Stage 3. If we now have proposals for history in Key Stage 4 within citizenship, it's important that this history interrelates well with what's been developed in mainstream Key Stages 1 to 4. Finally, as a conclusion, I show you this awful PowerPoint, the sort of thing you should never do because it's got too much prose on it. But I just thought you ought to see it as a whole, because it's a direct quote from one of our more recent history reports, and it's a good point on which to end. And the quote says this: history is highly relevant to us all and has an important job to play. Arguably, it's so relevant to our understanding of the contemporary world that there's a strong case that it should become a compulsory subject at least until the age of 16, and in various guises even beyond. This is why the weaknesses indicated by inspection evidence are of considerable concern. And the second slide, the last one, is just a reminder. Having said all I've said about history in schools being relevant, it's a reminder also about the essential focus of history. And it reads as this. This is what it says. However, the essential caveat in addressing issues is that history must not lose its integrity and become distorted for different purposes. History's main contribution to the UK's democracy has always been its plurality and unpredictability. Different historians coming at events and people from different perspectives, using evidence critically and with integrity, and presenting different views. Above all else, history needs to provide people with the ability to make up their own minds. There you are, a quick and perhaps garbled tour of the issues. I wish you good thinking, and it'll be very interesting to see what you come up with in your groups when you address the key issues we have set, and in particular, your response to the question, do you think that history matters, and why? Thank you.